Hello. I didn't realise until I read your emails and letters that there were quite so many people who shared the view expressed by last week's guests that it was time we abandoned our current obsession with change. It didn't much matter to you whether the change in question was being announced by politicians or management consultants or advertisers or public relations people. It was, you felt, an appallingly overworked word, which in most cases disguised the bald truth that nothing much at all was changing. Indeed, the more change was announced, the more it turned out to be, well, the same thing. But let me pull out a few of the more analytical pieces. I'm sorry about this. Just one second. Hello? Yes, no. Where are you? You're on a train? You are. Yes, that's great. No, I'm not on a train. No, I'm in a studio broadcasting house, and it's not really the best time. Look, I tell you what, tune into the second half of today's programme, and you'll learn about a society where they love their mobile phone so much they'll happily take and answer calls in church. Yes, in church. That's right, yes. Ciao for now. I am sorry about that, but back to those more analytic pieces of correspondence. Here's Harold Horvitz. I think Bertrand Russell put it best when he said, change is one thing, progress is another. Change is scientific, progress is ethical. Change is indubitable, whereas progress is a matter of controversy. Real change, and for that matter, real progress, is often invisible until some time has passed. That last sentence from Harold himself. And here's Roger Hicks. We have become intoxicated by change and dependent on it. It is usually referred to as progress, of course, or as a necessary concomitant of progress, although many are now beginning to realise that genuine progress is just one aspect of something larger and more menacing. Well, it wasn't so much change that interested Anthony Alcock as stasis. Interesting word, Laurie. It always reminds me of hanging about on street corners, an essentially static but popular form of social gathering in my neighbourhood until dispersed by the local constable who just assumed we were up to no good. My thanks also to Phil Bracci, Kathleen O'Neill, Viv Seedman, Mary Kiddy and Leon Jones. Now, here's an unchanging treat for you all.
Time now for Bells on Sunday, which this morning comes from the parish church of St Peter and St Paul, Lingfield, in the Diocese of Southwark. We hear them now ringing Call Changes.
Bells on Sunday. How traditional, how enduring, how unchanging. But such a reassuring sense of permanence can only really be maintained as long as we concentrate entirely upon the bells and ignore their traditional function of summoning us to church. Because nowadays, it would take considerably more than a Bob Double or a Steadman Triple to get most of us out of the warm house and down the road into a chilly pew. Nothing very new about that. For years, we've been hearing stories of declining congregations in the churches of the West. And most of us would probably regard it as little more than further evidence of the irreversible secularisation of modern society. And that's exactly the commonplace assumption, which is radically challenged by a new piece of demographic research carried out by Eric Kaufman, who's senior lecturer in politics and sociology at Birkbeck College, University of London. Eric now joins me in the studio, together with, it says in the script, Eileen Barker, who's an emeritus professor of sociology with special reference to religion at the LSE. But the trouble is that Eileen's interest in religion hasn't so far been quite enough to allow her to miraculously escape from a jam on the A40, so she may join us as the conversation goes on. But meanwhile, Eric, let me start with you and say, your paper wants to show the importance of demography in explaining religiosity and secularism. And you cite, at the beginning of it, some very, very fascinating, really fascinating historical examples. Let's start with the contentious one. I mean, you say it's contentious, it's not yours, but it's the one about why Christianity took off so quickly in the Roman Empire.
Thanks, Laurie. Yeah, this actually comes out of a book called The Rise of Christianity by a religious sociologist named Rodney Stark. And Stark makes the sort of counterintuitive argument that really it wasn't just Constantine, the Roman emperor deciding to endorse Christianity rather than feeding them to the lions. It was actually a process that occurred almost inevitably through demographic change. That is, the Christians increased from about 40 converts in the year 30 AD to something like 6 million in the year 300. So a growth rate of 40% per decade, which he puts down to higher fertility, more female than male converts, and lower mortality.
So our old story about this wonderful religion being adopted because it was so extraordinarily acceptable to people is thrown into doubt by this argument.
Exactly. Exactly. He's saying it wasn't this incredible allure to the Hellenistic mm-hmm. pagan population, but rather the fact that they simply grew their own to a large degree. Yeah. And then when it came time, there was a tipping point and Constantine chose Christianity.
And we can take a rather more up-to-date example of the growth of the Mormon religion in the States, can't we?
Exactly. The Mormon religion in the States has exactly the same 40% per decade growth rate that Stark attributed to the early Christians. And there are other examples, maybe not quite so fast, but the evangelical Christians in the United States in the 20th century had a very high fertility rate.
So the Mormons overtake other religious groups. I think somewhere in the paper they've overtaken the number of Jews
exactly.
because of this fertility.
Amongst those born after 1945, there are more Mormons than Jews in the U.S. Mm-hmm. today, which would have been unthinkable, really.
Yeah. Let's now turn to the way in which you're using demography to undermine or to question the secularization thesis. Perhaps we ought to say a little word about this secularization thesis. I mean, baldly stated, it is simply the idea that as societies develop, modern Western societies develop, so religion becomes less significant. There's a decline in attendance at church, and there's also a decline in belief, isn't there? But I mean, this is something that many sociologists in the past have seen as almost an inevitable concomitant of modernity.
Absolutely, and really, if you look at the work of the classic sociologists like Karl Marx or Emil Durkheim, Max Weber, they all almost assume this inevitable process of secularization, which comes out of the Enlightenment. However, there's two different components. One is attendance, which tends to be relatively low by comparison with belief. A simple question such as, are you a religious person or not, or do you believe in God or not, is another type of measure. So you could maybe not go to church but still believe in that sense.
I see. So if we were measuring secularization, we wouldn't simply look at the empty pews and say, look, it's happened, it's almost there now. We'd want to sort of also ask people whether they did believe in God or whether they...
Yeah, because the reason they may not be attending might have to do with decline. And simply their propensity to join or participate, or they may be more under pressure or various other reasons.
Now let's turn to the specifics of your actual research. I mean, you, in order to measure exactly what's going on in terms of religious belief and in terms of religious attendance, I mean, where do you look? I mean, you look at some existing data, don't you, for this?
Yeah, I do. I've looked at the European Values Survey and the European Social Survey, two sort of surveys that have been running, at least in the case of the European Values Survey, for about 20 years. And by the way, just I have to mention that this will be published in Prospect's mm-hmm. next issue on October 20th. So, European Value Survey. So what they ask is, they ask people, first of all, how often they attend church mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. attend a place of worship. Secondly, they ask, are you a religious person or not? The answer is either yes, no, or I'm an atheist. So uh-huh. those are the key questions.
Okay. So now when we look at these figures and what's going on here, I mean, in some sense, we find evidence of secularization going on because we do see a reduction in figures for attendance and belief. But then this needs to be countered, isn't there? This needs to be countered by other tendencies which are going on in Western societies.
Yeah, I mean, I look at 10 Western European countries, 4 of which are broadly Catholic societies and 6 which are mainly Protestant. And there's a real difference. The 6 societies which I call early secularizing include France and 5 Protestant countries. Britain would be in there as well. The late secularizers, Ireland, Spain, other Catholic societies. And what we find is in the cutting edge, if you like, secular societies, the Protestant ones in France, we see a kind of exhaustion amongst the younger generations. That is, if we take the 1945 generation, those born 1945 and later, there's no difference in subsequent generations. So there's a flattening of that trend.
So when we're looking there, there's no end point to the secularization, really. It seems to have stopped at a certain point, and at that point that we still go on having believers and attenders. It doesn't go any lower.
Well, that's sort of how it looks, that it looks as though it's flatlined at about somewhere around 5% church attendance, very low, but something like 50% who say they're religious, mm-hmm. which is quite high, actually. Yeah.
So here is one argument against the secularization thesis. I mean, it doesn't seem to be going on. It's not evolving towards a position of complete non-belief. We've reached that. But the second one that you want to talk about are about declines in fertility and shifts in fertility. Now, tell me a little tiny bit about how these are significant and important.
Sure. Well, first the context is we're living through a period of below replacement fertility. That is, not enough children to replace the adult population. And so in that context, populations that are not declining to the same extent become very important for determining who's going to be alive 40, 50 years from now. Sure. And in that context, I found that religiosity, that is the answer to the question, are you a religious person or not, mm-hmm. next to marital status is the strongest predictor of an individual woman's fertility.
Uh-huh. Now, we've also got to talk about immigrants here. I mean, in a way, to some extent, anecdotally, people say, oh, good heavens, we're being swamped by Muslims or by Islam. You know, one comes across this sort of statement being made.
Sure.
I mean, so what is the effect upon immigrants, upon, if you like, the religious ambience of the society? What's that doing to the secularization thesis?
Well, people, I don't think, always focus on the fact that immigrants are changing the ethnic makeup of the country, but they also change the level of religiosity in a country, because immigrants tend to be more religious than the host society in Europe. Particularly Islamic immigrants, the second important thing is that they do not, in the second generation, tend to lose their religion to the same extent as Afro-Caribbean and
East European. In a way goes against common sense, because you have a slight idea that people arriving into a materialistic sort of consumerist society, the idea right. that their religious affiliations would grow, would weaken, but they don't.
Well, that's what you would expect, and that is something we haven't seen. And in a way, the secularization argument relies upon Muslim secularization as well, given the fact that Muslims will form a significant percentage by 2050, certainly in Western Europe, of the population.
So if I ask you, and it's a difficult question to answer, but when you build in all these variables that you're talking about, how many years do we have to go ahead in order to say, well, just a minute, the number of people who are religious in some sense or other have more than made up for those people who are abandoning religion and overtaken them. And we could say that, in fact, the secularization thesis has been reversed now. And right. in Western Europe, we now see countries which are much more religious than they were previously.
Right. I think you have your finger right on the point. It's a contest between religious growth through demography and religious apostasy, on the other hand. I've done some projections which suggests that we're going to see sort of a trough of, that is, the peak of secularization will happen about 2035 to 2045. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 21st century, we're going to see much higher levels of religiosity. Now, that's even without immigration. Yeah. With the immigration, it's going to happen sooner than, I believe, than 2035.
Apostasy, of course, being your word for people who are leaving
religion. Sorry, yes,
giving it up. No, that's fine. No. As an ex-Catholic, I recognize the word. And so on. Let's talk about the tiny bit, just to finish off, if I could. This is so interesting. But what are the political implications of all this? I mean, when you look forward to this society that your demographics are describing,
sure.
what do you see these societies being like? How do you see new coalitions and new conflicts brought about by this changing religiosity?
Well, I think it's quite interesting, and we can see in the United States, where you had a demographic growth of the evangelical Christian population, we saw after the 1970s the rise of the religious right and mobilization of that population, which is very important in terms of electing the Republican Party. Now, there isn't as large an evangelical Christian population in Britain. That's not going to be at the same level of the American one. But you might see alliances across ethnic lines based upon religious conservatism. So you might have traditionalist Christians, traditionalist Muslims forming an alliance. That may seem unlikely, but if you look in the American case, what happened was, and what is still happening, is an alliance between evangelical Protestants, traditionalist Catholics, and Jews. And before 9/11, religious Muslims were part of that coalition. So it was seen as a morally superior thing to white nationalism in the U.S.
I'm interested in the notion that we might see a resurgence of Christianity which comes about as a response to Islam. I mean, people say, just a minute, I mean, we've seen the argument over the Pope's statement here. We've seen, as it were, almost people forming battle alliances, battle lines. I mean, do you see Christianity becoming, how can I put it in quotes, perhaps more dogmatic, more fundamentalist, as a response to what is seen as a more dogmatic Islamic presence?
I'm not sure I would, partly because I think the response thus far has been to say, well, we are moderate as opposed to their dogmatism. So I don't think that's true. But what is interesting is, in some studies that have been done, show that in areas of Britain, for example, where that have higher Muslim populations, more of the white British population tends to identify as Christian. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to church or even believing, but it does indicate some kind of mobilization of identity going on.
That is such an interesting, and I do hope we have many letters about that. But the end of the secularization thesis, as illustrated by a demographer, Eric Hoffman, thank you very much. And I'm sorry
we didn't have
Eileen Barker to join in our discussion. The last 3 or 4 minutes, I saw her arrive breathlessly next door. All I can do is I hope that you've not been too overstrained by your traffic experience, and I wish we could have miraculously transported you here, Eileen. But I want to thank other people who wrote in now in response to the item we had last week on why white working class boys fail to improve upon the occupational status of their parents. Here's Paul Billingham on that subject. He said, I just wanted to say how much I appreciated your programme today. I'm a teacher working in a special school for 11 to 16-year-old boys and girls with emotional and behavioural difficulties. I found what was said very interesting and useful. It was refreshing to hear opinions and findings from experts that actually made sense and gave insight into the complex difficulties that disaffected young adults present. Whenever we have praise for social science, we always mention it. Ruth Loveday-Jones, though, unfortunately, was rather less impressed. What was not addressed by your contributor was the continuity of an education system that is devised, implemented and administered by a middle-class establishment and based on middle-class culture and values. In the case of both black boys and working-class white students, their cultural values and experiences rarely coincide with those of educational institutions. In a way, Ruth, I'm sorry to quibble, but I think you're just perhaps being a tiny bit unfair, because that, in a way, is the issue at the heart of Gillian Evans's work. So do read the whole argument if you've got time. It's fascinating. You'll find details on our website. And here are our addresses for your comments on this week's programme. I imagine we'll have a very large number of people writing in about that end of secularisation thesis. It's Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London W1A, 1AA, or email thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. And of course, you can hear the programme again and again and again, and find a further reading list and sign up for my newsletter. It cleared up my disfiguring eczema in just two treatments, writes H.G. of Poole, by going to this site and clicking through bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Good evening and welcome to the Money Programme. If you're one of those people who likes to get away from the telephone every now and then, it's about to get a great deal more difficult. The phone you can take anywhere is coming to Britain. The new system goes under the rather prosaic name of cellular radio from Washington and from London. Mark Rogerson now reports.
It's now just coming up to lunchtime, which is early evening in London, so time to call in and see whether there are any messages. Needless to say, in the centre of a park like this, there are no public telephones. Doesn't matter. Britain will take a big step nearer to gaining its own portable phone system in the next few days. Then the changes could be dramatic.
Well, that was Moneybox back in 1982, getting its predictions absolutely right. It is really, isn't it, difficult to think of any other technological innovations enjoyed quite such a dramatic advance as the mobile phone, from absolute novelty to utter ubiquity. I think there are about 50 million currently in use in the UK, and all that in just two decades. But even as I say that, I can hear muttered objections to my use of the word advance in this context. What exactly has been advanced by the mobile phone? Love, happiness, business, friendship, prosperity? Well, I think each of those propositions might arouse a fierce debate in this country. But perhaps we can more readily test the benefits, if any, of the mobile phone by looking at other societies, specifically perhaps in relatively underdeveloped countries, which, according to several leading economists, might find the cell phone a vehicle for the elimination of poverty. And that's exactly the research task undertaken by Heather Horst and Daniel Miller in a new book called The Cell Phone, An Anthropology of Communication. It's a study of the manner in which the cell phone has transformed, or failed to transform, the lives of low-income groups in Jamaica, who until a few years ago lived almost without a phone of any kind. Well, Daniel Miller, who's Professor of Material Culture in the Department of Anthropology at University College London, he now joins me. This study is part, really, of a general interest on your part and the team that you work with of looking at the way in which the new media impact upon poverty, isn't it? Can you just sort of outline your general concern?
Yes, it is. We worked as a four-country comparison, actually funded by the Department for International Development, and they're targeting poverty and low-income families. And the question really is to see precisely, as you just said, given the ubiquity, is this actually going to be something of considerable benefit? Is it part of economic development and so forth? And the point is that everyone is coming from all over the world now and telling you that in country after country, people who before had no phone at all, I mean, the landline was quite sluggish in development, suddenly have mobile phones. So we come into a place like Jamaica, and we started in 2004, and we find there too, you know, less than half previously had the phone. But although the new company with mobile phones came in around about 2001, by 2004, in a population of 2.6 million, you have 2 million phones. phone subscribers. That's 3 phones per household. In fact, our book starts with a little story about a local bus being held up, and they went in and they got 26 phones, and then they counted the passengers, there are 29 passengers, and they would not leave without the extra 3 phones. Now, in that situation, the phone is likely to be having a major impact, and what we need to find out is what that impact precisely is.
Now, what about this? Because, I mean, there are economists around who we know, and we've heard about the digital divide, and people said, well, the digital divide is a terrible thing. We've got to make certain everybody has computers. Well, I mean, we talked about computers and about phones, because once everybody gets computers and phones, we don't have this digital divide, and there'll be enormous benefits for those people who are living in underdeveloped societies. If that was the sort of argument put forward by some economists.
Yes, I mean, if you read The Economist magazine, for example, a lot of the development literature, they feel the phone might do what they thought the internet was going to do, but more effectively, and bring major economic development to each of these countries. Mm-hmm. But the situation turns out to be rather more complex, because if you read that literature, what they're arguing is that the phone is going to be used by people to do things like, say, find jobs, or they're going to become like one-person offices. You don't have to pay for an office anymore. You've got a phone and everybody can contact you and you can become a sort of entrepreneur. And when we look at detail at the Jamaican situation, we find that on the whole, actually, that's not true. I'm sure it's true in many other countries. And that's the point about anthropology, is it's the generalisations you can make. But at least in Jamaica, while you can find instances, you can find, for example, a fisherman who, with a camera phone, when he catches something, he sends the picture back to the tourist hotel. And if they want it, he keeps it. And if they don't want it, he puts it back. But nevertheless, in the main, people were not using it to find jobs and they weren't becoming entrepreneurs through the phone. But what we found was that it was enormously important for highly impoverished households, actually for quite a different reason. Mm-hmm. When we went into this in detail, we found something like a third of the people we were working with at that income level, well, they didn't have any income.
They were very poor areas, there were two different sorts of areas, perhaps we should say.
That's right. I mean, basically, we're traditional anthropologists. We live with the families we're working with. We lived with the family of a taxi driver in the Kingston area, and we also lived with a family in a remote part of rural Jamaica, specifically focusing on these low-income areas.
Sorry, I interrupted you. We're talking about what they were. So we're beginning to talk about what they were using their phone for, as distinct from what the economists thought they might use them for.
Well, the problem we found, as I was mentioning, was that there were so many people, up to a third, who actually didn't really seem to have an income. And they just simply are not the jobs available, and there aren't the entrepreneurial possibilities. So the question is, how actually do they survive? And what we found is the phone really comes in there because they need to make contact with whoever does have some money and hope in some ways that the money will trickle down, as it were, to them. Now, for example, you have the remittance system, which is well established, where there are Jamaicans living abroad. And in the old days, maybe they might send back at Christmas a large sum or something. But now you have a mobile phone and also connecting in with something like Western Union. Now, for these people, even something like educational textbooks, or you're given a prescription by the doctor and you don't have the money for the medicines, what do you do? And in this case, you can actually make the call, and within 10 minutes, a small sum actually comes and helps you with the immediate economic crisis. So in that sense, the phone becomes part of that kind of much wider network by which people on very, very low incomes are, in a sense, able to survive. And a lot of that redistribution is actually occurring within Jamaica.
So we have someone, as you say, who is faced by a certain predicament. They have to pay for a prescription, have to pay for a school textbook or something. And then on their mobile phone, they have a long list of numbers, because there's a long list of possible contacts to go to for this. And what is the call like? Because I noticed that anything you talk about the length of the call, which is very interesting. Right.
Well, this fits into a particular system which works in Jamaica in a very different way from here. The average length of call is 19 seconds. Now, why would that be? And the reason is that what people do is they have a very extensive network of friends and relatives that they know. And even when they don't have a specific need or reason to call that person, the Jamaicans call it link up. They like to keep in touch with these people. So a typical call is something like, hi, what happening? Everything fine? Laters. End of call. And it just keeps the sort of thing on the boil, as it were. And when a time comes when there is an opportunity to, as it were, make use of that contact, the contact becomes important, the contact's then kind of there and you can have a different kind of phone call. And that means that people are connected with sometimes hundreds of other people. So it's a different sort of system.
And you also talk about the ways in which the call is made not necessarily in relation to a specific economic problem which is facing the person, but also just to relieve emotional, sexual pressures of various sort. I mean, the word pressure is quite a familiar one over there, isn't it, to describe the difficulties of life when you're poor and without a job.
That's right. I mean, it just thinks of sort of Bob Marley's music and so forth. It's a very common term. And basically, people have notions of pressure upon my head. You know, the fact that there's all sorts of stress that comes with impoverishment. And the networks that we're concerned with should not be reduced precisely to those economic needs, that there are many ways in which just having somebody to talk to and becomes just as important, obviously.
So it's a therapeutic function, really.
It's very much therapeutic. And the word Jamaicans often use is counselling.
Yes.
In a sense, people actually want, they enjoy the counselling role in many ways. I mean, you get stories of people having a kind of miscall, but they pick it up and they say, well, why did you call? And then they sort of start a conversation and then they aim to be very helpful.
But there's a positive function. But of course, in a way, there's a contradiction here, isn't there, between what the economists were saying. This might encourage entrepreneurialism, but it sounds, if they are ringing up people who are almost equally as poor as they are in order to get money from them to pay for an immediate thing, there's not much opportunity for capital accumulation going on.
That's absolutely right, because for economic development, people need to pool money together and actually be able to use it as a resource for development. And if we're right in what we're seeing in Jamaica, the money is actually going downwards, redistributively from people who have little to people who have even less. So it's a much more complex picture than the economists, I think, have realised up to now.
Now, I mean, I just committed a terrible act before by having a mobile phone ringing on this actual programme, but there probably wouldn't be so much embarrassment if that occurred in Jamaica, because you talk there about the readiness to turn to the mobile phone doesn't seem to be hedged around with the same sort of proprieties that it is in this country. I mean, proprieties which are so strong that the trains now reserve special coaches for people who don't want to hear the ringing of mobiles.
No, that's right. We're desperately embarrassed if a particular kind of call happens when we're sort of on the tube and we're not expecting it. I think Jamaica people have more confidence in their... It's an oral culture in that sense. And often you get the feeling that people are actually having quite a loud conversation, and it's as much for the entertainment of the people who are kind of listening in on the side as the person they're actually making the call to. So again, the phone fits in.
Calls in church?
Calls in church are a little bit more problematic. I mean, as the preachers will say, you know, it's best to go, as they say, to the throne first, i.e. to God, rather than the phone to talk about the last conversation. But nevertheless, there is an understanding. There is always that sense, you know, that it could be an emergency. Yeah. It could be something really important. There is a tolerance, actually, to the phone, even in the church.
So you're looking elsewhere where you might find that there are economic advantages bestowed by the widespread use of mobiles?
Oh, certainly. I mean, this is an economic advantage for the people who really need it. It's just a more complex picture. But it was a comparative study, and the people I'm working with, for example, the people in South Africa, it turned out to be much closer to the expectations that are given in the standard economic arguments. You have to do it country by country.
Well, Daniel Miller, it's a most interesting thing. Nice to hear about how other people use, stroke misuse, mobile phones. And since you ask, yes, I do have got my own mobile. Yes, I have. It's not the very latest model. It's not the one which, according to the latest joke doing the circuit, goes ping when your brains are cooked.